Hey there, listeners. Just a little housekeeping before we begin. We are in the middle of transitioning from our old studio to a new studio. So today we aren't going to have a video version of the podcast on ABC News Live. But just as a heads up, in the future, it's usually on at 4:30 on Tuesdays at ABC News Live. You can also check it out on our YouTube channel. Again, we'll be back with those videos very shortly, but we are just in the middle of transitioning to a new studio. And if our audio sounds a little bit different today, that's also why. Anyway, enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. What is the savviest political strategy on impeachment for Republicans in the Senate? Today, we're going to try to answer that question with a new edition of 538 Debate. We've done this a couple times before. Basically, we've each been assigned a position to argue, and we'll try to poke holes in each other's cases. But before we get to that, we have a couple new developments to discuss. Over the weekend, President Trump announced that the leader of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, died during a U.S. military raid in Syria. We're going to discuss the political implications of his death. We're also going to ask why there appears to be so much disagreement in national Democratic primary polls. And here with me to do all that, our senior politics writer, Claire Malone. How's it going, Claire?
Good.
Also with us is managing editor, Micah Cohen.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
And we have with us senior writer, Perry Bacon Jr., joining us from Kentucky. How's it going, Perry?
Doing great. Glad to be here with you guys.
And Nate is out today, but we've got plenty to discuss, so let's get to it. And let's begin with the death of al-Baghdadi. There is obviously a national security angle to this story, but that is not our expertise, so we're going to focus on the politics. Micah, Osama bin Laden's killing is probably the most obvious comparison to this. So how did that affect public perceptions of President Obama?
Obama got a meaningful but fleeting bounce in his job approval rating after the killing of Osama bin Laden. You know, you saw his approval rating tick up among Republicans, which obviously Obama didn't get good ratings among Republicans. So if the bin Laden killing is the right comparison to make, then maybe we'd see a small but fleeting bounce in Trump's approval rating. I tend to think it's not a good comparison.
Why not?
Because no one knows who he is. And Osama bin Laden was number one boogeyman. And when he was actually killed, it was a worldwide event. And this, I think, because Baghdadi wasn't the same sort of figure, and frankly, because Americans seem to care less about this war, in part because there's Middle Eastern war fatigue, which isn't necessarily like a nice thing to say, but is very true. It just doesn't resonate as much culturally.
Is there anything different about the political situation for President Trump? Say this were an Osama bin Laden type figure in the American psyche. Is his approval rating malleable enough for this to even have a similar effect to Obama's? I think, what was it, like 6 points or something like that?
I was going to raise that point exactly, which is that Trump has been in this 38 to 42, 40 to 43. So I guess if he went from 38 to 44, that would be similar to 2011. But Trump's approval rating seems to not really change beyond sort of a 2-point range, plus or minus, based on really even really big events, Charlottesville, the 2018 midterms, various controversial things he said, so I just don't know that I can think of an event. It's hard for me to think of an event that's going to change how people feel about him. And to give a sort of a anecdotal that's not particularly useful, but does tell you something, I'm not sure that the booing at the baseball game last night tells us a lot. DC is very liberal, but I do think that I wonder if that crowd even thought that, hey, we just had this big event happen in national security. Maybe we shouldn't boo the president tonight. But I think people who are Democrats are booing the president whenever they see him right now.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That to go back to Claire's point, if the bin Laden killing had happened under Trump and then he had appeared at the national game that night, I actually do think the audience there would have thought, oh, this isn't the right time to boo, because the bin Laden killing was just a totally different context and occupied a totally different space in just the American psyche. So I think the fact that that liberal audience at the Nats game didn't think that, I think that is telling.
So you think it's more about the person who was killed, al-Baghdadi, versus Osama bin Laden, than that Trump is just a different president and approval ratings work differently given how Americans feel about him?
I think it's probably mostly about the former than the latter. I think it's mostly about this isn't a bin Laden level event. And that even under Obama, partisanship and polarization had increased to a point where I think you would have seen a bigger bounce if not for that after the bin Laden killing. But if anything, those forces, partisanship, polarization, have gotten stronger since then. So maybe are exerting an even more powerful, you know, limiting effect on how much Trump's approval rating can change.
I think Trump would elicit the same super partisan response no matter what. But I also think the way that he went about announcing the death was tacky is the only word that comes to my mind. And I think like the way he talked about, you know, obviously this guy is like enemy number one, right? But you can even look back at the way that Obama announced, we killed him. He got a Muslim burial, though it was at sea, right? Like they talked about, okay, we did bum, bum, bum. We did all these things in order to say like, we are better than he was. And Trump kind of, he died like a dog, like a coward. Like all that stuff felt very, I find it jarring to talk about the death of a human being that way, even if it's like a terrible person.
No, well,
and I think Obama kind of struck a note of, we assassinated this person in accordance with,
right,
you know, some dignity, like, and also in order to not raise the ire of many, many, many people in parts of the world who would have been ticked off and were ticked off. I lived over in the Middle East when bin Laden was killed, and all the coverage was Americans like running to the White House and celebrating, and it really left a sour note in, you know, many ordinary Arabs' lives. Not like extremists, just people saying like, it's kind of gross that that's happening. So that sort of felt like that was happening, but from the White House.
Yeah, I tend to think, and Trump like started off his announcement this way, but he could have like seized this as an opportunity to be solemn and presidential and commander-in-chiefy. But even by the end of the announcement, that had gone away. I don't think Democrats would be rallying behind Trump if he did that, but it doesn't help. Yeah.
To your point about crossing party lines, actually, if you look at the Gallup numbers, all of the increase that Obama saw in his approval rating after Osama bin Laden's killing was from independents and Republicans. His approval rating actually remained exactly the same amongst Democrats. And so it is entirely because it crossed party lines that he saw a bump at all. But anyway, let's move on and talk about the Democratic primary and the national polls, because they disagreed quite a bit last week. But before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Moskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having difficulty finding qualified applicants, so he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Try ZipRecruiter for free at the web address ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We're back, and last week there was quite a bit of debate over the state of the Democratic primary when 2 national polls were released back-to-back showing dramatically different results. So on Wednesday, CNN released a poll showing Biden 15 points ahead of Warren at 34% compared to her 19%. And then on Thursday, Quinnipiac released a poll with Biden trailing Warren by 7 points, 21 to her 28%. So, Perry, why do the national polls disagree to the extent that they do?
Why is a hard question. I'm not totally sure I can answer that one directly, but I did a little research into this yesterday. And what I can say is the Quinnipiac result was kind of in line with what Quinnipiac has been showing. They've been showing Warren kind of trending up and slightly ahead of Biden for a while. What you see in the national polls is Quinnipiac, 1, and then YouGov, which has a poll with The Economist, 2, and then 3, the Ipsos poll, which is often done with Reuters. What you find in those 3 polls is basically, best 2 months, basically a close race, kind of either Biden with a single-digit lead, both of them tied, or sometimes Warren with a lead. And then you have three other polls, which are that Fox one, Morning Consult, which occasionally polls with Politico two, and then three, the Harris poll, which is often done with The Hill. And what those polls have pretty much shown, even in the last 2 months, is they have Biden ahead in the high single digits and sometimes double digits even. So those are the kind of broad trends. Is the Quinnipiac in particular is a more, you know, a worse poll for Biden than some other polls are. CNN has not polled as much as the other pollsters have, so that one was a bit of an outlier. But you've had other polls like Morning Consult where Biden is pretty far ahead. So at this point, it's worth thinking about these sort of six polls in different ways and kind of separately from one another and in those two blocks I described.
What's interesting is, actually, when I first saw these stories, my initial reaction was, I wonder if they're just underestimating how much sort of random variation there can be in polling and in sampling. I think people tend to do that. You know, we see a lot of chatter. Even if one poll shows, you know, Biden up five and another poll shows a tied race, or that's actually totally normal, you know, there's a lot of variation you would expect to get just from normal sampling error.
Right, but this is 26 points that we're talking about here.
Yeah, which is a lot. But Laura Bronner, our quantitative editor, did a look at these polls, an analysis, and basically found what Perry found, which is if you look at the results by candidate, so you look at, for example, like how large is Biden's margin, the result is way outside of the normal range we would expect from sampling error alone. So something is going on here. Now, sampling error isn't the only type of error you would expect to see in polls. But what Laura also found, and Perry was getting at this, is that once you account for house effects, basically the idea that different pollsters, because of different methodological choices or different sampling methods, tend to get different results, then that weird variation or the over large variation basically goes away. So I think what we have here is there's something going on in the way Quinnipiac, for example, conducts its polls versus the way, you know, CNN or YouGov conducts their polls that is finding different results.
I mean, it's probably the question I get asked the most about is like, what's wrong with polls? Are polls going to be bad in 2020? And so I think people have a lot of curiosity about this very stuff, if you're very in the weeds about politics. It feels like one of the holy mysteries, right, of all this, you know, how Nate does the model or how different pollsters decide their methodologies. I think that is what leaves a lot of people, including me sometimes, right, like very curious. It's like, well, why did you weight this one group more? And what is the reasoning behind that? And how was that decision made? You know, is it a single person? Is it a group? Is it a consensus within the polling group? But yeah, a lot of this stuff is singular to the organization. And that's not necessarily, I think, a satisfying answer to people. People kind of just want to say, okay, but what is the state of the race? And I guess our answer would always be, look at the polling average and it'll give you a better idea.
Take an average.
No, and it is like take an average is really the best bet, because that's the whole idea is like, okay, you have on the one hand Quinnipiac making smart but at least somewhat subjective decisions about right. How best to do a poll. And you average that with Ipsos making different but also smart decisions. And you know, there's a collected wisdom there.
The other thing that's important to note here is when we look at polls for like approval rating and things like that, we take the house effects into account and then correct for them, right? So if you know that over a period of many months, CNN has a bias in favor of X candidate. And I don't mean bias as in like a political or partisan bias. Versus Quinnipiac, which may have a bias in the other direction. You can figure that out over many months, and then you can take that into account when you're averaging it with other polls. And so that is part of what we do in order to make sure that our averages are accurate.
No, and this really shows, I think, why you have to do that. We're actually going to be launching our national poll average soon.
That's kind of a big announcement. I feel like we get questions about that a lot. Do you know when it's coming out?
I don't want to give anybody a hard day, but no, it'll be coming soon. And one criticism of other averages like Real Clear Politics, who, you know, we cite them all the time and we love those. That's a service that they do that average all the time. But it's really bouncy and it's like all over the place. And if you looked at it, you would think, oh, my God, the race is changing all the time. And you know, Biden's up and then down and up and down. A lot of that variation is just house effects. It's what pollsters happen to be an average that day. And once you account for that, you know, Laura gave us an average that accounts for that. And what it shows is a really smooth race, you know, with Warren kind of steadily climbing up into the low to mid 20s and Biden pretty much holding steady. You could, if you squint, maybe you could see a slight decline, but, you know, he's in the mid to high 20s. Right. So
part of the story here is like the national polls really, in a certain way, don't matter. We don't have a national primary, you know, like Iowa starts and that'll change the polls and so on. So on some level, this attention to the exact average is sort of like not really represent the process. On the other hand, the national polls matter this year, I think, more than ever in sort of two ways. The first is the DNC is basically cutting out candidates based on the national polls. So we find out that some of these national polls are wrong or have been consistently bad. That is not ideal because the DNC is actually using the polls to, you know, include or exclude from the debates. And on some level, if you're Steve Bullock or you're Tim Ryan, I mean, they're low in every poll, but it's not great if the polling was proven to be wrong later on. The second thing is, I think we're all trying to assess this question of kind of what is the state of the Joe Biden campaign. On the one hand, he's still a co-front runner or a leader in the polls. On the other hand, he's having a lot of trouble raising money. And you have different accounts of that. And part of the reason why these poll results are so contested over the last week is because, is Joe Biden kind of a stationary candidate, kind of static, or is he in some decline? Because the fundraising numbers, and to some extent the chatter among the sort of political classes that Biden is struggling, but the poll numbers generally don't show that, and particularly the CNN result would almost show that he's in a great position. So I think the polls are more sort of fraught for that reason.
Yeah. And I think you've seen, you know, that narrative only added to with that report last week saying, oh, some big donors in the Democratic Party are asking other people to jump in. And, oh, is Sherrod Brown going to get in? And
Who is
Hillary Clinton going to get
Sherrod
in?
Sherrod Brown is at least like...
That is not a laughable thing.
Right.
Like, that is a... He is a potentially very strong candidate. He's kind of like... would appeal to Joe Biden voters, but is younger and also has some like progressive cred. I think probably Sherrod Brown has some degree of regret. But it is this weird... We're in a weird state because we're also in a news cycle where people are saying, whoa, is Elizabeth Warren too liberal for the general election? And I do think that that's a real concern for a lot of Democratic voters. It feels like a lull, and the lull makes people nervous, right? It's like the race has been like sort of steadily co-front runnery for about a month. And so everyone's like, well, what's happening?
What happens next?
What happens next?
But I think all this does suggest that these national polls, they do play an outsized role in kind of determining the narrative of the race.
For sure. And it's, I don't know, it's, I think people forget that Iowa is followed by New Hampshire, is followed by South Carolina, Nevada. Like they,
the reversed order this year, but yeah.
Nevada and then South Carolina. Like the order of operations thing is really important, and yet we don't necessarily talk about it in that way, like in the, you know, in national news reports or anything like that.
No, that's true. But in that sense, that's actually almost like why I don't mind national polls playing such an outsized role, is because at least then your kind of starting point from how you're assessing the race is reflective of the party overall, not 99% white. But it does, to the point Perry made earlier, that there's so much disagreement in the polls, not due to sampling error, but due to choices the pollsters are making, does shine a spotlight on the fact that we're using these polls to determine viability, and therefore what polls the DNC includes and what polls they don't becomes like a super high stakes decision.
Here's a question. How much do pollsters, or are pollsters willing to talk about their methodological reasoning? Like if you had, you know, the head of the Quinnipiac poll on and you said, why'd you make these, like why, what groups are you oversampling, or why are you weighting it this way? How willing are they to talk about that?
Perry, you've talked to them. I mean, in my experience, they're pretty open and willing to discuss kind of their methods and why they do what they do. The only tricky part comes, I think, when a lot of the decisions they make that aren't ideal are about money. So there's like, you know, it's like, hey, we had to do this to save money. So on those fronts, I think they're a little less.
Some of what I'm getting at here, too, is like, I can't tell if from a pollster's perspective, I'm sure they also worry on some level that people will misunderstand why they're weighting a certain group more or oversampling a certain group, and that their decisions will be read disingenuously. You know, there's these competing things of we should be more transparent about polling and its flaws. But then on the other hand, we also live in a news environment and a political environment where people are always looking for the disingenuous reading of things, frankly, from like the very liberal and the very conservative side of things.
Yeah, that's definitely something I think you saw over this past week when the two polls literally came out on Wednesday and then Thursday. You saw a chorus of people on Wednesday saying CNN is in the tank for Biden and they're just trying to push this and there are like political motivations behind this poll. And then, you know, on Thursday that Quinnipiac poll came out, instead of saying like, oh, this could also be an outlier or something like that, it was like, see, this Quinnipiac poll proves that CNN is in fact in the tank for Joe Biden. Anyway, yeah, I think obviously political Twitter is not America, but within that segment of political Twitter, there are disingenuous arguments being made about things that if you take a step back, you can explain in a pretty logical, if complex way.
Without like criticizing any of the individual pollsters too much, it's worth looking at these just as a, if you're a reader, if you're a listener or a reader looking at these things, it's worth looking at 538 has grades of pollsters. And then you can look at what the RCP, Real Clear Politics average, which pollsters they include. The Economist has an average of polls and you can look at which polls they include. Those are not the same polls that are included in each one. And 538 has ranked the pollsters. So I do think it's worth probing and thinking about. I agree the average is useful, but there may be some better and worse polls, and we have, you know, 530 has entered that discussion a little bit, so it might be worth thinking about that context as well.
Yeah, and actually, to Perry's point, we're going to be updating those pollster ratings very soon.
I know. I saw Nate scooping himself on Twitter.
Oh, he did?
Wow, the number one rated pollster.
Oh, he unveiled it?
He unveiled it. Should I say it? New York Times, Siena College.
Oh, okay. Well, congratulations.
Nate's editor learns about his self-scoop. Live on this podcast.
First of all, I always know when Nate is working on something. I just monitor his Twitter account. That's how I can tell.
Anyway, yeah, we're going to have those updated pollster ratings and also an average, as you said.
Yeah, and actually our average accounts for the pollster ratings. So our average, which doesn't exist yet but will exist soon, takes into account how accurate a pollster has been historically and whether that pollster uses best practices methodologically.
All right. Well, we've had a whole polling conversation without Nate. Nate, if you have any feedback, and if you're listening to this,
Nate,
which I imagine you aren't.
Nate, go home.
Nate, if you have feedback, send it to podcast@538.com.
And leave us a rating and review while you're there.
All right. Let's move on to our 538 debate. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by NetSuite. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources. And that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance and accounting, orders, and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/538. That's netsuite.com/538 to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35. Once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. This Black Friday, secure the best deal of all, a healthier, thicker hairline. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements, just prescription solutions backed by science. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today while supplies last and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's 4hims.com/538. forhims.com/538. We're back, and it's time for a 538 debate. The question we're discussing is, what is the savviest political strategy on impeachment for Republicans in the Senate? We've done this a couple times before. If you're new to the podcast, basically, we've each been assigned a position to argue that people may or may not think is the politically savviest thing to do, but they're going to argue it nonetheless. So we're each going to make an opening statement, and then we'll cross-examine whoever makes their opening statement for a little bit. So let's just begin by going around and having everyone say the position that they're going to be arguing in order. Michael, we'll begin with you.
I'm going to argue that Republicans should defend Trump at all costs slash not give any ground, vote to acquit no matter what.
I am going to argue that Republicans should let the facts and public opinion guide them along with the Senate trial, aka likely convict Trump.
I am going to be arguing that Senate Republicans should force a resignation from President Trump before it ever gets to a trial in the Senate.
I'm going to be arguing that they are applying no discernible political strategy here, and it's difficult to assess that because they are not operating in a normal frame of politics.
The chaos Muppet theory.
And to be super clear, people, we are not arguing about what is the morally right thing to do. We are arguing about what is the best political electoral strategy for Republicans.
We will delete your email if you misunderstand that.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, Micah, take us away. Give us your opening argument.
Okay. First of all, let me...
You wrote it out.
I made a couple notes to myself. First, I don't think Republicans can employ a strategy here that will all of a sudden make 2020 electorally looking roses and peaches. So the question here for them is really about limiting their losses, right? And how do you limit your losses? You keep the base behind you. I don't think they really have a chance to take the House. In fact, I think if you're Mitch McConnell, what you're thinking is, hey, I got to find a way, even if Trump loses, that I can keep the Senate. That seems like the best sort of damage limiting operation McConnell can do. Okay, so how do you do that? Real quick. You do that by essentially doing what you did with Kavanaugh last year. You don't, under any circumstances, give an inch to Democrats. Why will this work? We've seen it work before. People are kind of sheep. You know, we've seen public opinion switch around on free trade, on Russia. As long as Republicans maintain a party line, I don't think you would see the Republican base abandon them, as you did like at the very end with Republicans and Nixon with Watergate. It took those elite Republicans abandoning Nixon for a big chunk of his base too. So essentially what you would do is you would just say, this is a partisan impeachment. We're going to focus on the on substance and trying to get policy done for Americans. That has the added benefit of taking the strategy away from Trump. It sort of matters less what he's doing if you're sort of just pushing that aside and saying partisan, partisan, partisan. And it has the best chance of resulting, I think, in Republicans keeping the Senate.
All right, cross-examination time. I mean, first of all, how do you prevent the obvious suspects from breaking ranks with the party and therefore destroying this image of it's all just a partisan witch hunt if you have Susan Collins or Mitt Romney or Lisa Murkowski or Cory Gardner or some of these other senators who, like, how do you keep them in line under your scenario?
Oh, I think it'll be really hard to keep them in line. But I'm not arguing that that's possible. I'm arguing that that's probably the best course for to keep for Republicans' electoral prospects. But to further my point, I think your question gets at why this is a good strategy. Because the more Romney and Collins and Murkowski and then anybody else who comes along, the more impeachment seems like a bipartisan cause. And I think the more you'd see erosion in the Republican base. Like, think about it. In 2020, Democrats are going to turn out. That's essentially baked in at this point, right? The real question is, do Republicans turn out? In 2018, both bases turned out, right? And that's a big reason why Republicans kept the Senate. They won a lot of these red states in the Senate. If in 2020 you're going into it and all of a sudden Republicans have abandoned Trump, I think there'd be a good chance of seeing really depressed GOP turnout. And then you're talking about just like a electoral ass kicking.
But by this strategy, are you saying that the Republicans should basically like cede the presidency? Like they should expect that they're probably not going to win? Because when you're talking about losing those reluctant Trump voters, shall we say, I think of Scott Walker losing the governorship of Wisconsin, in part because in world famous Waukesha County, those, you know, tasseled loafers, Republican, you know, reluctant Trump voters, they stayed home. Right. So is this strategy basically saying like, yep, we're not going to win the presidency probably?
That's a very astute question, Claire, because I think it
is. Thank you. I do professionally.
I think it is.
At least for the interim.
I think it maybe not saying, okay, we're going to lose the presidency, but it's saying, you know what? Whether Trump wins a re-election or not is not within our control. We're going to worry about ourselves.
Mm-hmm. All right, Claire, it is your turn next. Time for an opening statement.
Okay. Well, I think that the Republicans should convict Trump and let the facts, public opinion, and trial guide them. If you look at our 538 impeachment tracker, you will find that people who think that Trump should be impeached, it's 48% of the public, and people who think that who are in favor of the impeachment process, it's 53% of Americans support that. So it's a decently popular thing to do. I don't know if people have been watching the news lately, but a lot of is hitting the fan for Trump. Testimony is not great. His White House counsel's efforts to stymie damaging testimony has largely failed, I would say, on some level. And the hits just keep on coming. At some point in mid-November, Democrats are expected to make a lot of the testimony public. So this is not going away. Democrats are sort of preparing a, I would say, more cohesive national narrative that will be damning to Trump. So the facts aren't great for Republicans. And I think I will agree with Micah's argument and say that the Senate is the real powerhouse in the United States government right now. And that the Senate pioneered this really kind of, you know, you can call it devious, you can call it evil, but the way that Senate leaders have manipulated the rules, the filibuster, what happens in the Senate can be a really powerful thing. And I think that it has become, over the past few years, the body that exerts the most power. So if I'm a Republican and I have a quite smart leader at the head of the Senate in Mitch McConnell, I would say, you know what? Let's defend the body that we actually have control over. I remember interviewing members of the Freedom Caucus, including Mick Mulvaney, who is now the acting chief of staff, back in 2016. And Mulvaney specifically talked about how it was good to have a blank slate president like Trump because it would throw power back to Congress. Republicans' true power lies in the Senate, just the way that votes are dispersed. You know, it's more likely to be able to operate offensively, right? The Republicans have an advantage in Senate elections, I think. And so they should sort of throw the president out and say, you know what? Half of us behind closed doors, maybe more than half of us behind closed doors, don't want to defend this guy. We do want to defend our colleagues. And it's in some ways much easier. It's kind of also, I think, has the added benefit of letting Republican leadership take back their party, right? And to begin to think about a Republican Party in the post-Trump era, right? Because there's, you know, we always use these hostage metaphors about the Republican Party and Trump. These senators, these establishment Republicans want their party back. And the way to do that is to publicly disavow the person that has caused them all this pain.
So just to be clear, your strategy for the Republicans in 2020 is President Pence, who could barely win in Indiana in 2016 for re-election and therefore join the ticket. He really was going to lose re-election in Indiana. So you're going to have President Pence, one, and you're going to have two. Donald Trump is not going to go away in a cave. He's going to each day be tweeting, "The establishment is terrible. How could they do that to me? Mike Pence is an idiot." Like, this seems like a great path for 60 Democratic seats in the Senate, 300 House, and Elizabeth Warren president by winning 370 electoral votes. How would this actually – this seems like a terrible idea for the party.
I think Mike Pence actually benefits from 4 years of standing next to Donald Trump. So even if he had a regrettable electoral position in Indiana, and perhaps that's the reason why he accepted the vice presidency, you will get the same apparatus that went into defending Trump and trying to make him seem a more palatable figure to the American public and to Republican voters. You will see that poured into Pence. And I think there's actually reason to think that that ground is soft enough and that people are desperate and, you know, Republicans, particularly those, let's say, reluctant Trumpers, or will feel desperate enough that they say, okay, sure, Mike Pence. You're right, Perry, that the Trump X factor of the tweeting and stuff is a problem. I think in some ways you will have to concede that you might, again, lose the presidency. But you could say, listen, the Democrats are going to elect a far left, let's say, Elizabeth Warren. That's who you're praying for in this strategy if you're a Republican. And you say, we'll take the 4-year mulligan, but let's hold on to the Senate and we'll come back stronger with, I don't know, Nikki Haley in 2024.
And we'll be a check on the Warren presidency. I think this gets at a big, big question, which is, we talked about this on the podcast before, actually, but if elected Republicans disavow Trump, let alone remove him from office, how much of Trump's power does that deprive him of? I think it's at least some, and I think I could make a pretty good argument that it's a lot. That once Trump is not head of the party anymore, and once he doesn't have the institutional backing of the Republican Party, that he would be far less influential with Republican voters. So the idea here would be, if Republicans do what Claire says and they, you know, the facts get worse and worse, they eventually vote to convict Trump in the Senate, then yeah, maybe Pence isn't great, but you can sort of carve out a slightly remodeled Republican Party in the same way Trump did, you know, after 2012.
So, but what's the advantage of the public disavowal part of this over forcing a resignation, right? You were saying, like, you want Republican senators to publicly disavow Trump. What is the political advantage there?
Keeping the Senate.
But as opposed to, like, if you just force him out behind closed doors, you never disavow him publicly.
Well, no, you can say, like, the idea that, listen, it's reached too far. You've gone a bridge too far. You can hide behind that argument of saying it became too much for us, the criminality or whatever, you know, the corruption was too much for us to bear. We really want to be faithful to the drain the swamp ethos, and therefore, you know, that means politically killing the person who started that thing.
No, and pursuing this strategy is essentially saying, okay, we think that public opinion among conservative-leaning independents, among swing voters, is going to get so anti-Trump that it really hurts us in even right-leaning states, right? So if Republicans are going to break with Trump, they have to do it in a way that signals to those voters, like, hey, you can still live in the Republican Party and hold your held up high. You know, if they don't have that public break, then it's almost the worst of both worlds.
All right. So I will now make the argument that you absolutely do not want that public break. I am responsible for the argument that Senate Republicans should force a Trump resignation before it ever gets to a trial in the Senate. And like both of you, I agree that the utmost priority should be to keep the Senate. I just think that there's a better way of going about doing that. And essentially, they need to keep the Senate because that's the only way that they can confirm judges if there is a Republican president in 2020, and they can thwart liberal policy if a Democrat wins. So this mentality goes, Democrats are likely holding on to some of the most damaging information until the public impeachment proceedings begin in the House. Now, if you look at polling, independents are slightly in favor of impeachment. Once those public hearings begin, it won't be possible for senators in purplish states to support the president without losing those independents. And we're mainly talking about 5 vulnerable senators here. It's Collins in Maine, Gardner in Colorado, Ernst in Iowa, McSally in Arizona, and Tillis in North Carolina. And you're going to see ads in both directions pressuring these 5 senators to either support the president from conservative groups or break with the president from liberal groups. Now, what will end up happening is if they break with the president, they could very well lose primaries. And what would result from that is you have an even less electable Republican going into the general election in those purple states. If they stick with the president, they've basically tied their fates to Donald Trump, who in the states where they're residing all five of those states has a net negative approval rating. And already you've seen that those senators' approval ratings have fallen since the impeachment inquiry began. Now all but one have themselves a net negative approval rating. So basically, voting in the Senate is a lose-lose. You either lose your primary or you lose in the general. And Democrats only have to pick up three or four seats, depending on who wins the presidency, to gain the Senate. That is a risk that Republicans should absolutely not take. And ultimately, we know that Republican senators do not like President Trump. This removes any risk of him winning in 2020. This is kind of like their one shot. In some ways, Democrats are doing them a favor. And learning from the Watergate era, obviously Ford pardoning Nixon was not a good move for the Republican Party. The way that they force him to resign is have Pence pardon him, but then also not run for reelection. We know from the Reagan Revolution that it's a little embarrassing to have somebody resign in scandal, but Americans are forgiving. They will get past it quickly, and you can come back better and stronger than ever before. Not to mention that if we get to 2022 with senators still supporting Trump and Trump in the White House, you have Republicans defending 20 seats, Democrats only defending 12 seats, and you have senators in states like Wisconsin, North Carolina, Florida, Ohio, Iowa, up for election. So looking down the pike, things become catastrophic if Republicans don't force him out quickly.
Hit him up, Perry.
So I'll raise three different points here. The first is that I think there's a group of Republicans. I would put Tom Cotton in this group, Marsha Blackburn in this group. I'd say those are the leaders of it, who will adamantly oppose any effort in the Senate to push out Donald Trump and will like make their colleagues look like they're sort of like rhino sellouts for doing it. So I really think the incentives for that, like Tom Cotton, there's like 10 Republicans who really believe in Trump, and they're going to make it really hard on the probably 30 for people who don't really like Trump. And that's a really big barrier, I think, is there. The Susan Collinses seem like they matter, but Tom Cotton will be on Fox News every day saying that these other people are not real Republicans unless they stand with Donald Trump. The second will be, obviously, Donald Trump will never, ever, ever resign. I think you probably know that, but I think that's worth saying. And then the third thing is, I feel like all three of these arguments have kind of rested on the idea that Donald Trump has like a 20% chance of winning re-election. If Donald Trump has something like a 45% chance of re-election, which is what I think the number is closer to, 45 than 25, then why would you take all this risk when you just won in 2016 on kind of a lucky bounce? The Electoral College worked in your direction. Maybe you had some foreign governments that helped you that you might be willing to do that again. So are we sure that your chances are so low that you want to sort of tear up the party when you have like a 40% chance of winning the election again?
Wait, okay, so that's three-pronged critique of my argument. One, the reason that you do this behind closed doors is so that you don't have people like Tom Cotton on Fox vilifying.
Well, Tom Cotton will keep it behind closed doors.
Yeah, I think, so, Galen, no matter what, even if it happens behind closed doors, this thing is becoming public quickly.
Right. So forcing a resignation, I acknowledge that the weakest part of this argument is how do you actually make it happen?
Yeah.
I think it's something along the lines of Mitch McConnell finds his 20 fellow Republican senators who would back removal of the president, compiles every single ongoing case against the president, paints a picture for him of what life outside of the White House without a blanket pardon would look like. It's probably a jail cell, and then informs him that he has all of the votes whipped up to remove him from office if he does not agree. Obviously, that still may not work, but that's what that conversation looks like. And then lastly, I don't think that this argument hinges on Republicans believing that Donald Trump will necessarily lose. I think it just hinges on them prioritizing their success in the Senate over whatever the hell happens to the president in 2020.
Yeah, Perry, that's what I was going to say is I think you're right that a lot of this does come down to what are Trump's chances of winning another term? And that includes what are his chances of sort of like of not even making it to that re-election fight. But it also, that is sort of one part of a two-part equation for Senate Republicans as far as the presidency is concerned. And the other part is at what cost, right? So maybe Trump runs in 2020, has the same Electoral College advantage he did in 2016, and squeaks out another win, but in the process – Gardner and Collins and all those people are kind of wiped out in the Senate. Essentially, it would be like what we saw in 2018 with the White House playing the role of the Senate and the Senate playing the role of the House.
Also, Perry, so yes, what you described was President Trump getting lucky in 2016. But imagine if there was a more orchestrated campaign in 2020 with Nikki Haley. So Mike Pence says he's not going to run for re-election. You have Nikki Haley at the top of the ticket. She picks, you know, Dan Crenshaw, this young veteran from suburban Texas who can help Republicans in Texas save the state house from having a chamber be lost to the Democrats. They end the trade war with China. They run on historically low unemployment numbers, a continuously growing economy, and saying that Democrats are obstructing on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal. You know, in this post-Trump world, we Republicans are now the adults in the room, and the Democrats during the past 4 years have become crazy socialists, and we want to continue this economic success. Like, why does that not sound like a better picture for Republicans to paint for the country?
I mean, if you can get to Nikki Haley as the president and Trump not attacking her each day, I guess that's a better I just don't know how to discuss that one. That's so hard, far from where we are now. It's like Nikki Haley, whatever you think about her, is, I would argue, kind of, if you look at her record on like immigration comments, she gave some speeches that are pretty critical of Trump in the past. I just feel like she in particular, I think, would sort of set up a kind of Republican civil war in 2020, where it'd be very easy to Trump to say, not only was I unfairly removed from office, but you replaced me with this sort of like, you know, rhino-y, pro-immigration, like yeah. That. I think they should go with Tom Cotton over Nikki Haley.
Yeah, it's the best argument in favor of Republicans abandoning Trump to some extent is essentially what you were getting at, Ken, which is like in a lot of ways, the fundamentals favor Republicans, right? The economy is doing well, at least for now. Democrats just won a bunch of seats in the House in 2018. So to some extent, they're kind of overextended there. And Republicans are on pretty firm ground in the Senate. The problem is, so if you could just remove Trump from the political calculus, Republicans have a lot going for them, right? The problem is, how do you do that without igniting a Republican civil war? I think, Galen, your proposal is sort of the worst of both worlds, but let's get that.
All right, yeah, let's get to Perry, your argument for strategy is around.
All right, this is the there is no electoral strategy available here. So I'm going to read this quote from Pete Wehner. He's a Republican. He was a senior staffer with Bush 2. He's one of these never Trump Republicans. And he said this on CNN a few weeks ago. People decided early on for a variety of reasons to accommodate themselves to Donald Trump. I think some of them thinking that things would get better, that he would grow in office, be surrounded by good people. He's gotten worse. But having made that accommodation early on, they didn't feel like they could get off. And now it's not just a defense of Trump, it's a defense of their defense of Trump. And so to indict him is to indict themselves and to indict their own judgment. And that's hard for any human being. And what I'm not trying to do here is make a moral judgment in reading that. What I'm more getting at is like, I think a lot of discussions that I read assume that we're in a electoral strategy environment. You know, Mitch McConnell is this brilliant electoral strategist. I think that's true. And that therefore he's looking at his polls. He's talking to his colleagues. He's thinking in that strategic way. And that's not what I'm seeing. And the reason I look at that is you have these resolutions. The House had this resolution to basically censure Adam Schiff. And then Lindsey Graham has a Senate resolution to basically attack the investigation and to say it's too secretive and it's too mean and so on. And I think the old Mitch McConnell that I used to cover, what he would have done was he would have wrote a resolution that Susan Collins and Mitt Romney and Cory Gardner and the kind of more moderate Republicans were for, written it that way, and something that was so written so moderately would have put pressure on, say, Doug Jones or Joe Manchin or a person running it in a who's not a senator currently, like sort of a Mark Kelly, somebody like that who's running to be in the Senate in a swing state who's a Democrat, where you put pressure on those people and make the investigation look partisan. It would be great for the Republicans to be able to say, even Doug Jones thinks this investigation is too secretive. Maybe the Democrats should open it up. And that would be a smart electoral strategic approach. But they're not behaving that way. They're behaving a little cult-like, like Matt Gaetz invading, you know, this room where the hearing is going on. The resolution in the Senate was written by Lindsey Graham, who has become kind of Trump's best friend in this weird way and is sort of pushing other Republicans. So to me, an electoral strategy would like center on how do I make Susan Collins and Cory Gardner comfortable, and how do I make Doug Jones kind of have to join our team or not? And we're not seeing anything close to that right now. And so that's my argument for basically these guys are not playing the same game they used to, and they're not making any decisions that look electorally smart at all to me.
Perry, isn't it decently easy, though, to have the caucus come together and say basically the mistakes were made line vis-a-vis their judgment and defense of Trump? And if you get a big enough contingent of Republicans to say mistakes were made, aka Trump and defending Trump, that it could sort of drown out the voices of the Tom Cottons and the Marsha Blackburns, and that you could right the ship, that it's not just all chaos and it's not all beyond repair, that it's simply almost like a people's fear of the president's TV and Twitter reach. But if you band together enough people behind the scenes and then go public, there's still an effective or possible way out for Republicans.
I don't want to rule that out. I just think that enough people have made enough comments. Just the defenses of Trump and the things he's done, I think, are going to make it. It's almost easier to, like, one position would be that having foreign assistance in an election is bad but not impeachable. You've seen a fair amount of Republicans do that. I think that's where Mitch McConnell and Lamar Alexander are. But you've seen other people, a fair amount of this one, basically say foreign interference is, you know, it's just something that's done. And I don't know, that's an easy, hard position to back out of. And let's be honest here. The liberals, the Democrats, the media are not going to make it easy on the Republicans. They're going, you know, your choices here is the choices stand with Trump or break with Trump and be mocked constantly and like, and have, I don't think the, like, if you look at how Jeff Flake is treated, he is not treated like some kind of hero by the left or the media. He's treated by, you voted for most of the things Trump did. Look at your Trump score. So I'm not really sure that path is going to be easy for them.
Yeah, I mean, some of this all goes to the absurdity and power of Trump's mockery, right? Like, the thing I think that people fear most on a fundamental basis is someone rejecting them or making fun of them. But if enough people band together and say, actually, this guy's the fool. There's a Gaelic word called Amadon, which means basically like complete fool. This guy's the Amadon.
You looked at me while saying that. Is that because my name is Gaelic or because I'm a fool?
I don't know. I think it was just doing, I was trying to do
she doesn't
the,
know, she
I
says.
Was trying to do the rotating left to right, but yeah, we'll leave it open. But what I'm saying is, I mean, in some ways, this is the most complicated thing and yet the most simple thing, which is basically role reversal. And it requires some strategy behind the scenes for Republicans to say, he's going to make fun of you, he's going to make up a nickname for you, but if enough of us say, can you believe this 70-something-year-old man here tweeting about this? I mean, in some ways, it would be easy because more than half the country seems to feel that way, right? You would probably get a lot of plaudits from the media, right? And like, there would be some positive attention for you. So couldn't you have the power, if Trump's power is communication and media, couldn't you also turn his greatest power against him?
Yeah, I don't think they're very good at that, you know, or at least not as good as Trump. The thing here is, like, I think Perry makes a good point, just in reminding us that, like, not all of what we're seeing, at the very least, is 12-dimensional chess, right? A lot of this is people's idiosyncratic views and a lot of this, people have their weird reasons for doing what they do. I guess, though, Perry, I do think that all the behavior you're describing can also easily be explained by electoral incentives, where, look, the median seat in the Senate and the House is like R plus six or R plus seven, right? In other words, there's a Republican bias just in those chambers, right? Let alone the seats that Republicans now control are even more or even redder than that. So they have every reason in the world to circle the wagons around Trump, maintain a party line just based on electoral reasons alone. And then when you add into that all the evidence we've seen that, like, frankly, politics is nihilistic to some extent. There's not a there unless you say there's a there. So I don't get totally, Perry, how where your argument diverges from my the argument I laid out. Does that make sense?
Mine would be that they're not pursuing an electorally smart strategy, because I think the Democrats having this process behind closed doors, the Democrats are not brilliant at politics. So the fact that Doug Jones has not felt any pressure to criticize the investigation, Doug Jones is in a heavily pro-Trump state. So the fact that none of the moderate Democrats, like in these blue, the Democrats who've won in Trump districts, Doug Jones, I mentioned, I think a more optimal strategy would not just be unifying the Republicans, but also, challenge, like, McConnell did stuff during the Obama administration where they resulted in Democrats voting against things that Obama was for. Famously, all the Democrats in the Senate basically voted against closing Gitmo the way Obama had laid out. Like, I think if McConnell was like focused on how do I win more Senate seats and he had the sort of the real control here, you'd see a different strategy. And this one is less electoral and more tribal. The balance is, we mostly agree, Micah, but I do think I've seen McConnell in smarter moments and he's hemmed in by Trump.
What if the reason that they're not putting forward resolutions or positions that moderate Democrats can get on board with is because there simply aren't any? Because the facts are so bad that Doug Jones is never going to feel like he needs to defend Trump.
That's possible. I do think most people in the world are for transparency generally. So if you made a good argument for why these hearings are closed, like Matt Gaetz leading the movement to make the hearings more transparent is not going to move anybody. But there's a way that I would argue there was a way to, I guess what I'm saying is I do think there are ways that this is not, that politics is always movable on some level, and moderate Democrats are afraid of their own shadow. Doug Jones is very worried about losing re-election. I mean, if you can't like make Doug Jones seem a little bit nervous, I don't know what your strategy is not working.
Can I ask a quick question just about, since we're talking about Mitch McConnell, he has obviously come out and said, basically, I have to hold a trial in the Senate. But there was a period of time where, you know, places like Lawfare were making these arguments that, like, you know, technically McConnell could like make an argument to say, we can't actually have the trial, blah, blah, like whatever it was. Do we think it's all significant that McConnell has said, yep, got to have that trial?
I mean, it's definitely a little bit of leverage over Trump at least, right? Like if you're in a position where you want to try to control the White House or contain the White House, you know, given that other establishment figures are now gone from the executive branch, that's a way to do it. I don't know if that's what he had in mind or if he went home, read the Constitution and said, this is actually something we need to do. I'm not sure.
I think it is significant. I also think, I'm trying to find it right now, but I saw some reporting about McConnell saying that the Chief Justice would have a lot of say in any Senate trial too. Look, I do think to take a step back from our argument, it's not the modal outcome, but I don't think a Senate acquittal is like a fait accompli. I think the facts are really bad. They're only getting worse. And you haven't seen like huge breaks in the Republican wall, but you've seen a couple cracks, you know?
Can I say Micah is totally wrong briefly?
Yeah.
I mean, I think the reporting here is off. Like I read that Washington Post story, Republicans in hushed tones are worried about what, I mean, sure, if your sources are Mitt Romney and Susan Collins and like four other people, I feel like the Tom Cottons and the Blackburns are underquoted and the Romneys are overquoted. And I just don't know that the odds of a 20 Republicans standing in public and rebuking Donald Trump at 90%, it seems fanciful to me. And I feel like it's almost like suggests that the media is not growing out of sort of I'm not criticizing Micah, but I do feel like there are stories I read that have a sense of the coverage that this is like we're talking about 2014 and we're maybe in times where the norms of what we're looking at don't really work here.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that story this morning, Perry, reminded me of some of the coverage of Democratic senators in vulnerable seats during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. And it was all about, do I follow what is electorally smart or do I follow my moral compass? And that Post article seemed to have that framing around it, right? The idea that like everyone's, all of these Republican senators are having this.
In the coat room.
Right. Moral crisis. But like, what do they do? Like it seemed to have echoes of that.
We should begin to wrap things up by deciding who won that debate.
I think the listener should vote.
Okay. So listeners, tell us what you think.
Then rate and review us.
Give us a 5-star review. Tell us what you think. Just to reiterate, Micah, what was your position?
Keep the party line no matter what.
I was let the facts and public opinion guide GOP Republicans, so convict Trump in the Senate.
I was forced resignation before a trial ever reaches the Senate. Perry?
I was, they have no discernible strategy or they're flailing at all costs.
Perry's going to win because that's the actual situation.
People really shouldn't vote for mine. Mine is kind of not really in the parameters, so it may not be helpful.
But I will say that this all elicited an interesting discussion about the power of the Senate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And about the other thing that was clarifying as part of this is just how much, what are Trump's chances in 2020 and how that affects the Senate is just like so central here.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
if you think one of us won, give us a 5-star review on iTunes.
Sounds good.
Nate, you can vote on Twitter.
Yeah. All right. Claire, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
Micah, thank you.
Thank you.
Perry, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon. Ooh.